Welcome to the first episode of Star Wars Untold Stories, a new podcast by Entertainment Weekly covering the world of Star Wars. I'm editor-at-large James Hibbard, and I'm here with EW critic Darren Franich, and we're about to discuss the first episode of The Mandalorian, and hopefully our podcast won't have nearly as many technical problems as the launch of Disney Plus today. The streaming service went online early hours of the morning and has been plagued by glitches and crashes. I don't know, to me that seems pretty expected. I actually wrote like half of a story about this yesterday just in anticipation of filing the rest and posting it this morning because I was so convinced that there's just no way that this was going to go smoothly.
Yeah, I have to agree. It seems like a positive thing if enough people are immediately utilizing a service in the very wee hours of the morning that it crashes a little bit. James, this never happens for me with new things that I'm excited about, but I somehow managed to sign up for Disney Plus at like just the right time where I watched The Mandalorian even before midnight Pacific time. So I kind of watched it, wrote the review, and then woke up today being like, oh, I guess there were glitches somewhere, which it's funny to see that kind of happen just as people across the country were sort of all signing in. Did you experience any issues with your Disney Plus stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I had a couple error messages and I just redid it and that popped up fine and then went onto Twitter and saw all the madness.
And you did not go on Twitter. Well, this is the thing. And you did not immediately go on Twitter and say an error message, by golly. Is this just because of our age, James, that we're kind of used to? Like, I had whole, like, unsaved Star Wars video games that would end with an error message. Like, this is not something that tends to rub me the wrong way.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's like Tuesday morning. It's like, you know, how ruined is your life, really, if this isn't working immediately, something that you didn't have previously that you'll now have moving forward. You know, it's fine. You know, and for Disney, I mean, honestly, I don't know how they react internally to this, but I can only imagine that, you know, if they're smart about it, they're like, this is great. You know, everybody's talking about wanting to be on our service. It's like, man, you know, that darn restaurant, you know, it's, you know, I can't get a reservation. I want to go so bad. You know, it's like, everybody knows this is not going to be the way it's going to be on an average day moving forward. And it just kind of illustrates the amount of demand that there is.
Disney has kind of a you can't beat City Hall vibe to it in general when it comes to a lot of things recently. So I can't imagine they're too concerned about this. But James, you know, you've been kind of deep into The Mandalorian for a while now. You know, you wrote a great cover story about The Mandalorian for Entertainment Weekly, and you've been kind of reporting on it. But you claimed to me you had not seen the episode before it launched. And you've lied to me before in the context of Game of Thrones. But broad thoughts about the episode, you know, finally seeing it after kind of being deep in this world already for a while.
All my lies were just to protect your viewing experience, Darren. I mean, it was there was all like benevolent things, you know, trying to think of what will make you happiest moving forward.
Isn't that what all the bad guys on Lost you used to say? That seems pretty accurate. So thank you, demigod figure for controlling.
Yeah. I'm only killing off half the population for the environment, Darren. I mean, it's for the betterment
Snap.
Of man. Yeah, so Snap. I saw about a half hour of clips that included about half of this episode. And they definitely didn't include, I think, kind of the weakest moments from the first episode in those clips. So a lot of the early first blush reviews that sort of came out from members of the media that saw the clips, I mean, they're sort of kind of cherry picking scenes a bit. I overall liked it. I think I liked it a bit better than you did, based on your review that's on EW.com right now, if anyone wants to check that out. You know, I really like Pedro Pascal's laconic line delivery. I like the classic way it shot. The IG-11 murder bot was cool. Overall, I was in.
We should say that Pedro Pascal is playing the main character, the Mandalorian, who is not Boba Fett, even though his kind of whole iconography is very much inspired by Boba Fett. We got just a little bit of his backstory. He is a bounty hunter like Boba Fett was, but, he does have what seemed to me like some interesting stuff mixed in with some stuff that felt a little familiar. He is kind of tied in with this kind of seemingly diaspora tribe of people. We'll see what happens with that. But I really like Pedro Pascal. It's weird to me, James, that there are now like two of the most charming people who were ever on Game of Thrones have joined the Star Wars universe to wear helmets all the time. You've kind of mentioned this in your writing. I have to imagine that's not going to be the case for him for the entire run of this 8-episode season. But I agree. I liked his line delivery. I felt like he kind of gave just a little edge of sadness to stuff that was like pretty much gruff talk. You know, this was kind of like, you know, I could take you in hot or I could take you in cold. Like that felt a little, a little wannabe badass to me. But I am intrigued by him. I guess to me, my problems with the episode were those scenes in between you're talking about that were probably not reflected in the exciting preview edition of this. It felt like it dragged quite a bit. It seemed like it really wanted to be a Western. I remember you mentioning in your cover story, I think, that the milieu of The Mandalorian is really meant to conjure up kind of specifically the early and like Tatooine level stuff in the original trilogy, which I do tend to really, really like that stuff. And I like the idea of kind of setting a whole Star Wars saga there. But something was a little bit lacking for me. Maybe some of it was just that a lot of the techno talk in The Mandalorian, like at one point, Werner Herzog said he was going to give someone a fob, which seemed to kind of break the universe a little bit for me. but it was...
Two-factor authentication is very important for security purposes in the bounty hunting world.
Apparently it is. But it was Werner Herzog saying it. How did you kind of feel about some of the characters that we saw on... It sort of felt like we had like a mini adventure at the start, and then the start of the larger story was kind of the second half of the episode. Is that kind of a fair read on what we saw in this premiere?
Well, one of the things I was surprised by is when it came up on screen, I did the quick check to see how long it was, and it was like 39 minutes long. I can't remember the last time a major drama series launched with a pilot that short. And I like that they are holding back so many of their series regular characters for future reveals. We didn't see Cara Dune, who's played by Gina Carano. We didn't see Moff Gideon, the former Galactic Empire governor, who's played by Giancarlo Esposito. I mean, there's a lot of people yet to be introduced, so I thought it was smart that they just spent, took their time to sort of introduce this one guy. You know, I was a little bit disappointed in the mid episode reveal that he's like, donating to this displaced Mandalorian charity. You know, it seems a bit early to reveal him as a killer with a heart of gold, and which kind of nukes the most obvious, arc for him to go, to go from this kind of colder person to this more caring person, which is the obvious sort of route to take. It almost seemed like the show was super eager to assure you he's a good guy.
I think that's the stuff that I really struggled with. It's funny hearing you say that, because you kind of had in the first act, this attempt at a real man with no name setup, just this guy who's very laconic, who walks into a tavern and kills lots of people, literally cuts one person in half, and then gets a ride with somebody, and the guy giving him a ride dies, and the person that he's capturing he immediately freezes in carbonite, and it's all these kind of signifiers of here's someone who is a loner, is a lone wolf, is doing his cool thing. And I guess that if you buy what this show is selling in the first episode, then you're kind of like, oh, but there's more complexity to him than that. As you said, he is seemingly gathering all these bounties. He's a bounty hunter, which is like kind of classically a sort of cool wrong side of almost the wrong side of the law kind of a job. But he's doing it for the right reasons. He literally says that he was a foundling once. He's doing it for the foundlings, which sounds a lot like younglings, which is a little disturbing in the context of Star Wars lore. But yeah, for me, It just felt a little bit like they were trying to kind of have it both ways. You know, I acknowledge that, like, I come at this from the perspective of someone who, in, like, the 1990s, there was a lot of Boba Fett-adjacent comics and books and video games and everything that could kind of own the darker sides of that, of this milieu, a little more than I think this show is. By which I mean none of those ended with Boba Fett or a Boba Fett type shooting another bounty hunter to rescue a baby, which we should maybe talk about. That's a spoiler, I guess, but that's the other kind of big talking point after that first episode, right? Is the last few minutes of the show.
Yeah. But you know, before we get to that, I want to get to one of your criticisms in your review that was right there in the headline that I've been, like, very eager to sort of talk to you about all morning. And that is that you describe it as ultra violent, like an ultra violent trying to be family friendly fare. And I didn't think it was ultra violent at all. So I'm sort of curious, you know, where you
sort of
got to that.
Well, James, you know, I'm a new father, so I think a lot more about violence than I probably used to when I was watching.
I was watching and rewatching
old spaghetti westerns, but the truth is, I still really like violence when it's done in an interesting way. My wife and I, one of the last movies we saw before Kid Ride was John Wick 3, and we've not stopped talking about it since. My issue with this was it felt like it was doing all these moves that were ultra violent. This is a guy who in the first episode, as you said, a short pilot, he walks into two different places and kills a whole lot of people, and it's just done in this extremely bloodless way that's kind of bloodless even in the context of the franchise. I've been kind of rewatching the original trilogy, and, you know, I don't think the original trilogy is like a major meditation on violence and warfare, but, you know, there's stuff like when Obi-Wan Kenobi cuts off a guy's arm, it's bloody, and it's a little bit of the, you know, there's both the consequence of the violence and the kind of catharsis of it, and the excitement of it as well. And this to me just felt like it was really trying to be like, look at this guy, he's going and shooting all kinds of people. The first 5 minutes, he cuts one of the squid aliens in half. But also, he loves babies, he's doing it for the kids. And it's something about that, the sort of PG-14 nature of the ultra-violence, that kind of rubbed me a little wrong. And again, like, you know, just by comparison, there's a version of this story, I think, that would not be made by Disney that can kind of own that stuff. I mean, you know, the final act, I think, was very explicitly a slight homage to the original Django by Sergio Corbucci. Of course, a film that looms large in the context of all Mandalorian stuff, because Boba Fett's dad wound up being named Django. And, you know, when you're dealing with that, that movie is extremely violent, extremely fun, and kind of can do the visceral thrills. And this one, it just seemed like it can't do the visceral stuff. It just has this empty violence going on mixed with a kind of family-friendly quality. And that kind of rubbed me the wrong way a little bit. I acknowledge I might be overthinking it, but, you know, it makes me worried in the context of where the show is going if this is kind of the starting point. So I struggled a little bit with that. I will say also, it was just kind of a gray and grim episode of television. It didn't really feel to me like it had much visual flair, which I know you were kind of saying that you felt like it actually had kind of a cool vibe to it, or that it was kind of doing something interesting with this material.
Well, I mean, first of all, I now understand better about what you meant by ultraviolence, because, you know, the first thing I thought of is Obi-Wan cutting off the guy's arm, and that was all bloody and graphic. And, you know, of course, extra crispy Uncle Ben and Brew barbecue scene, you know, which was horrifying, you know, and that was in a movie that was what, like PG rated, basically. So to me, you know, just lots of space laser, you know, bloodless space laser stuff. You know, even Darth Maul getting cut in half was like more graphic than this one person being cut in half, because that was at least on camera. But I understand what you're saying in terms of, well, you know, the responsibility of doing it, that sort of like high bloodless body count combined with the sort of, you know, family friendly vibes that it feels like a bit of a violence cheat in a way.
It feels like it to me. Again, you know, I am intrigued to see where this show goes from here, because as you said, the end of the episode seems to imply that the change that you'd expect at the end of the story may have happened at the eighth point of the story, which could imply that, you know, there may be a difference in that going forward.
Yeah. I mean, Werner Herzog Herzog's enunciations were to me probably the most violent thing in the episode. I mean, that was pretty, I was feeling pretty you know, beat up by the end
of his speechifying. Yeah, I will say too, as far as just kind of greater Star Wars universe stuff, for me, you know, I'd love to know what people think about the kind of wealth of iconography that runs throughout the episode and burning Salacious Crumb and all that stuff. To me, the most interesting thing was when you're kind of following the Mandalorian into this mysterious room where he's going to get his new job. And the first thing you see are a bunch of stormtroopers who kind of look like they're the Pigpen from Peanuts equivalent of stormtroopers. They're just kind of messy and a little pitiful. And, you know,
they've turned mercenaries for hire now. So they're still wearing their old uniforms, but they're not, you know, actually stormtroopers.
I thought that was just kind of interesting because, you know, in the new movies, you kind of have the First Order, which is basically the Empire by any other name. And, you know, it doesn't seem to me like there's much difference between that and the Empire of the original trilogy. It's interesting that this is kind of very much set in this time of stormtroopers are now mercenaries. They're kind of a little bit more on the run. They're a little bit more secretive. I thought that was an interesting thing to play around with in the context of this show, kind of bridging the gap between the trilogies.
Also,
knowing the
more about Gelcoat
when the fourth round would
don't you call in the
don't touch that dial. That's right, we're still calling it a dial here because it's Emmy season on the Awardist. With the dazzling Oscar season behind us, we are now turning our attention to smaller screens to track which shows are headed to the podium and which shows stopped us in our tracks. Join me, Jared Hall, Entertainment Weekly's executive editor, as well as EW's TV-obsessed staffers, every Thursday starting April 4th, as we share our opinionated hot takes and insight into the Emmys race. The Awardist will get behind the scenes with the creators and stars themselves during in-depth, can't-miss interviews. Follow the long road to the Emmys with the Awardist podcast, Thursday starting April 4th, on your favorite podcast platform, and be sure to check out more Emmys coverage at EW.com/Awardist.
Okay, so we should talk about the Yoda baby scene.
What's your interpretation of that Yoda baby? Is it Yoda's baby? Is it?
I mean, that brings up the idea of, you know, the visual of like Yoda boning, which I just can't have in my head. I mean, it's just like,
let's,
you know,
see, it took us exactly 15 minutes for someone to say Yoda boning. There we go. That's the kind of podcast that we're setting a tone for here. I mean, I assume that's just a member of his race, not necessarily his child, because as we learn in prequels, Jedi don't necessarily, it's a rare thing for Jedi to have children.
Maybe less rare as the franchise
goes along.
You know, Lucas has said before that he wanted to keep Yoda's backstory a mystery, that he didn't want to ruin something magical by over explaining it, cough, midichlorians, cough. So, you know, there's not a lot out there about the Yoda species. You know, there have been a couple other examples of them along the way. And obviously Yoda died at 900 years old in Return of the Jedi, which predates this series. So, you know, it's unclear. I would be, you know, maybe it's a family member or not. You know, it's a bit unclear. And, you know, and also the client said the target was 50 years old. And if the Yoda baby is 50 years old and still helpless and has to be carried and swaddled, I would think that would be such a torturous existence. You know, there's something sort of Black Mirror-ian about that, about a 50 year old that still is like bound by like a childlike body.
Yeah. That was a very interesting thing to throw out there. This idea of like, because when Yoda said he was X hundred years old, you assumed, oh, well, you've been an adult for most of that time. And it's an interesting new revelation, like, oh, I guess actually your age just kind of works in a much slower capacity. So yeah, your first 50 years must be really exciting for your parents. You know, James, I have to point out that there was a trading card I think it was a trading card or maybe a magazine cover back in the 90s. Okay, I'm looking for it right now. That like showed like a temple of the Yoda race, which was like the only, you know, at a time when like, you know, you were sort of saying, oh, what is and isn't canonical. This was kind of the one thing that was like, whoa, like, were all the Yodas force positive? Were they all kind of like mystical like him? And I'm intrigued to see if that also becomes a part of the Yoda baby story. You know, one thing I'm always kind of frustrated about with new Star Wars stories is there's always this idea of like, we're going to do a story that's not about the Force and then ultimately kind of becomes about the Force. I was a little more intrigued by the possibility that, you know, the Mandalorian, our main unnamed character, do we have a nickname for him yet? Is he just,
Just Mando. You know, at the moment.
Well, but okay. That sounded like an epithet to me, the way the guys in the tavern said it to him. So I was a little nervous about just kind of throwing that around.
That's what they call them on the set. You know,
gotcha.
Mando. So I don't think it's necessarily negative.
Mando Dalrissian. It's interesting that, you know, you set up the idea of him being a part of very unclear what you saw flashbacks to him as a kid, clearly suffering through some terrible kind of purge. Seems to be the idea of kind of playing around with a lot of refugee stuff in the midst of the Star Wars universe. I was wondering if like that might be what's going on with the Yoda baby. There's kind of a Children of Men thing, like a lot of people trying to find him. Is it a rare species? Intrigued by that. You know, any kind of Children of Men adjacent narrative is definitely kind of interesting. So we're concluding not Yoda's kid is our current hot theory.
Maybe some Yoda nephew or something. It's hard to say.
Not all Yodas are related, James.
You know, another question I had, if all those people that Mando killed were protecting Yoda's baby, did he just murder a bunch of good guys in that sequence?
Well,
there is no spoon, right?
Yeah, it's a little unclear, right? That sequence, I will say also, I just thought it was kind of shoddy action filmmaking. I mean, I know the director of this episode, Dave Filoni, did a couple really great Star Wars animated shows. I'm really intrigued because there are some good directors kind of lined up for this first season. Outside of the staging, to me, the best kind of visual effects of this episode were the IG droid that you mentioned. I thought that was just kind of, I mean, again, using a droid who has kind of lived in Star Wars lore for a long time, but just the sort of effect of the way it was turning its limbs around to shoot all of the guys. I thought that was an interesting, a nifty twist. Some of the monster stuff I was kind of less invested in, but that kind of gave me some hope that there's some interesting stuff kind of happening on the digital side here.
Yeah, in general, the CG was quite good. It was pretty rare that I was like distracted by it, and you know, for a television show to do that, there's a reason why this is the first live action Star Wars show, and it's not that it's the first time anybody ever thought of it. It was thought of, and in development, there's one in development like 10 years ago, and every time a network would look at it, they just said this is just too cost prohibitive to actually do. But thankfully, because CGI has gotten cheaper, and because the desire to get into the streaming game and how lucrative that is has gotten amped up so much. Now that we can finally actually have something like this.
Got to mention, too, that Taika Waititi voiced the droid, who seems like he was not very long for this world, ultimately. Although I assume that there'll be a million more IG droids.
I assume he's coming back. I assume that that's not the last that we're seeing of that character.
Can you talk a bit about like what is kind of coming up, James? Because, again, you know, you've kind of talked a little bit about how there are these characters that we haven't met yet. Carl Weathers, who appeared for just a quick second, I didn't realize he's in charge of the Bounty Hunters Guild on the show. I kind of thought he was just like, he was the sort of local, local chieftain sending out deals. The Bounty Hunter Guild stuff is interesting. There was various writings about that back in the 90s that I forget about, but this seems like it's kind of a fresh start. How did you feel about the puck based economy of the,
it was fine. It didn't distract me. I was into it. There was a thing that you said earlier about it being very kind of gray core, you like that in terms of the visuals. And that's something I've noticed kind of creeping into the Star Wars universe, in general, I first kind of noticed it in sections of Rogue One, and then Solo was one of the most grayest looking movies that I've ever seen.
Really? I
mean, the whole thing seemed to have this kind of gray tone to it. And
that's interesting.
And here there seemed to be a bit of that as well. And I'm not sure the reasoning for that, because you look at New Hope and Empire. I mean, they pop. I mean, they're not sort of grimy and gray and dark tone films.
I mean, even Return of the Jedi, which I think filmmaking wise is kind of a step down from those two, the stuff in Jabba's palace and Jabba himself is just like, you know, he's, you know, a pustule of colors kind of on screen. That's funny. You know, Solo is the one movie I have not seen yet, because it kind of came out and people I knew and trusted said, you may not have to watch that.
Yeah.
I didn't realize
that. That does have a Game of Thrones character actor without a helmet on.
That's true. Okay, so one out of every three beloved...
I'll just throw that in there just before people on Twitter start saying it.
One out of every three beloved Game of Thrones characters get to come up and not wear a mask. Again, I have to assume, you've kind of written about this before, but Pedro Pascal, who, you know, very interesting line readings in this first episode, I have to imagine you hire him to do some face work at some point.
Absolutely.
I'm also kind of really intrigued to...
I can't imagine that he's just going to have his helmet on the whole time. I just don't see it happening.
James, we're talking all about The Mandalorian, but I'll be honest, I think the big news in Star Wars today has nothing at all to do with The Mandalorian. Can you explain? Well, James, I have a lot of questions.
Can anyone explain? I don't think anyone can explain, Darren.
Well, so you mentioned the glitches with Disney Plus. But there's one glitch in particular that seems to have been really purposeful. Can you run down what's going on with the first Star Wars movie and its new incarnation?
I mean, yeah, a classic scene in A New Hope, the famous and much debated Han shot first cantina scene, has been re-edited again, this time before Han fires. Greedo now only shoots first, but also shouts, and this is real, McClunky. So McClunky. In fact, well, actually, I'm not sure whether we'd get in trouble for playing the audio, but so I won't do that. But yeah, it's everywhere all over the internet. You will hear references to McClunky now and forever. There will be McClunky memes. I mean, clearly it looks like the latest attempt to kind of soften the scene where Han Solo preemptively kills Greedo. You know, they previously changed it so Greedo shot first in a rather clunky edit in 1997 special edition. And then he misses despite being at point blank range, which makes no sense. Now he says this mystery word. There's no subtitle, unlike the rest of the things that Greedo says to explain it. You know, we did find this morning a scene in The Phantom Menace when Sebula, and since you just rewatched Phantom Menace, you actually know who I'm talking about, threatens young Anakin, and he uses the word, and the subtitles indicate it might mean this will be the end of you. So basically, probably another threat just to edge that scene even further towards Han being justified in shooting. And it, you know, does this bother me when I'm walking around during the day? No, but it is one of those things I'm firmly on the side of. There was nothing wrong with it to begin with. You know, even under, you know, the most, you know, tight application of like some like Florida stand your ground law, you know, somebody pointing a weapon at you and threatening you and saying, you know, when Han says, over my dead body, and Greedo goes, that's the idea. That makes it clear to me that he is going to kill him. And that's all you need. You don't need anything else. You don't need, you know, any kind of sprinkles or sort of dessert toppings on that to kind of make that more clear to the audience what's going on. And the endless tinkering of that is has now gone to the point of just this new absurd level that I don't know. I thought it was pretty hilarious.
I think, you know, incredibly well said. And I had not even heard that about The Phantom Menace. That's fascinating to hear that was also kind of an addition. I'd love to know what kind of prompted this.
It wasn't an addition. It was apparently like in the original scene. It was just sort of rediscovered. You know.
But But he says the same.
While he was talking, but it was like in the middle of a sentence, so it didn't really stand out as much. But somebody,
found
it, and yeah, it's
But he says the same word. He says McClunky.
Yeah, it's the same word, but in the context of like other things, that's part of the translation
that's
on screen.
So
that's what it seems to mean.
I mean, who knows? You know, setting aside the question of, you know, did they reuse a clip of Greedo for that? Was there new audio recorded? Who recorded that audio? So many questions. This does bring up a larger, interesting thing about Star Wars in general, Disney Plus in general, the idea of, you know, we're all kind of, certainly you and I now are subscribed to this thing where some of the great works of entertainment are now housed. And it seems as if at any time they might change if they are so inclined to change it. And as I think a lot of people were discussing on social media today, you know, is this a very funny thing to add to a scene that was once cool? Yes. Does it look like something someone would do in like a funny YouTube clip? Like, absolutely. This for me is on the level of that clip that used to surface all the time of Darth Vader being being rude in Empire Strikes Back and just opening and closing his throne. Like, it's like it looks like that quality of editing. But I don't know. It's funny to think of there coming a time, probably in our lifetime, where it may be a somewhat regular thing to open these movies in, our Disney Plus brain implant and see a very different movie than we remember. But I have to say, it's very entertaining. I've watched the clip 10,000 times already.
it's funny because I was recently talking to Martin Scorsese for The Irishman.
Name
drop. Scorsese is currently, you know, embroiled in the whole thing where he, you know, called Marvel movies not cinema, and that had all the Marvel people, you know, politely slamming, you know, Scorsese for that. So it's interesting that he's the person that I'm citing on this, because I asked him about how Quentin Tarantino released an extended version of Hateful Eight on Netflix, and whether he has any interest in re-releasing any of his classics in longer form on the streaming service now that his movie The Irishman is coming to the streaming service. And he went off. It was great. He was just like, no. You know, that basically that the movie you release, that is the director's cut. That is the final version. And the only reason to ever change anything is if you're in the rare situation of a studio taking away your movie from you as part of some dispute, which is, you know, happens occasionally over the years, where the studio will take a movie away from a director and recut it because they don't like what they're doing. But that's a very rare thing to happen. So his point is, yes, there are all these things that happen during the filmmaking process that you might not like, and you might wish you had done differently, and, you know, weren't ideal at the time. But the movie sort of stands as a document to the best that you could do at that time, and that's what a movie is. And now, you know, of course, we're in this mode of where we can change that and we can do different things with it. And, you know, I guess I kind of fall a little bit in the purist, you know, camp, you know, in terms of wanting to keep things the same. But at the same time, when it comes to movies that I really love, you know, I'm always kind of curious to see, like, there are a few scenes that Stanley Kubrick cut out of The Shining. And
the hospital scene.
and his decisions were correct. But I would love to see those scenes, you know.
Yeah.
And Kubrick being, you know, even more hardcore than Scorsese, you know, he ordered, you know, all copies of those scenes destroyed, and only a couple photos now exist.
Well, and it's like anything else where, you know, you make a rule for yourself and you say, like, this is what I think. And then, like, in my case, I finally watched the David Lynch, the Missing Pieces edition of his Twin Peaks movie, which is just like a roll of deleted scenes from his movie, which I finally saw back in 2017. And, like, I think that's some of the best David Lynch material I've ever seen. So yeah, it's like, you know, you don't necessarily do a hard and fast rule and say this is and is not, you know, something I'm interested in. But to me, I don't know, it's interesting, you know, in the context of Star Wars, especially, which is now this living, breathing universe, we have these kind of two strands that this show will be looking at, you know, the movie that's coming up, the TV series that's ongoing, more TV series that are coming up that are set kind of all up and down the continuum. To a certain extent, I mean, the work of these TV series is historical revision insofar as it's like we're spending more time with characters at this point in the timeline. And, you know, I think that can be interesting. It is weird to me how with Star Wars now, people seem way more open to the idea of prequels than they did 17 years ago. But, you know, the idea that while they're doing that on a narrative level, you also have things that just keep changing. You know, I would hope that any more changes they do to the original movies or to the prequels will be a little less noticeable than the Greedo thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Though at the same time, I'm about to contradict myself a bit because when it comes to changing
I love
movies.
It.
They're, you know, I'm really contradicting myself here, but many of the changes that were made in the original trilogy, I actually like, and those are the ones that you don't notice. You know, those are the things that are like, you know, how they, when, like there's one shot when they're running through Cloud City and they added things out, you know, out the windows that they weren't able to do. And some of the shots when they're, you know, flying around the X-Wings just kind of look better in terms of the planets in the background. In other words, there's a lot of subtle backgroundy things that aren't, you know, animals like vying for your attention, you know, they're jumping around on one foot. That there's a lot of, you know, subtle tweaks to the special effects and the backgrounds that I don't mind.
Oh, see, this is where we part ways, James. I prefer Bespin. Yeah. Bespin, when it's just all white walls, is my dream version of Bespin. Had a certain Malibu Rehab vibe to it that I realize I really enjoyed as a young person.
I have spoken.
It holds. It's as simple as that.
that's another thing from the episode I've been meaning to reference. Nick Nolte's character who just ends conversations by uttering the words "I have spoken." I think that's my new favorite reply. You know, when somebody tries to continue a conversation after I've said something, it's just be like, "I have spoken."
My new favorite thing to say is "I don't ride a blurg," which was said in that same Nick Nolte part of the episode, which we didn't discuss for a reason. James, we're kind of wrapping up this week, but I do want to point people to all the great reporting you've done on The Mandalorian already, and especially in your original feature. Just a lot of great information from the cast, great information from the showrunners. You know, I'm somebody who's very skeptical of the show after the first episode, but everything they're saying about it and where it's going, you know, as a TV critic, you know, I kind of prefer reviewing a show after seeing a few episodes. That wasn't possible with this one because we didn't get screeners in advance, but it's one that I will be following along with you. Is there anything else that people should kind of know about The Mandalorian coming up? Because we are in a major Star Wars period right now between Mandalorian and Rise of Skywalker coming out next month.
Yeah, well, I think it's important to point out that what we're doing with this podcast, we're going to be talking about various things in the Star Wars universe, including some rewatches of a couple classic titles from the original trilogy and the prequels and the Disney trilogy. We're going to be talking about you know, The Rise of Skywalker when that comes out.
Yeah, and you know, our goal with this podcast, we're calling it Untold Stories. That's partially because James is going to be referring to his awesome reporting from within the Star Wars galaxy far, far away. And it's also because, you know, we're hoping with rewatches, we're hoping with kind of close examinations of the new TV series, the new movie, and beyond, to kind of delve into one of the fun things about Star Wars and all its incarnations. And, you know, I'm not somebody who loves everything about Star Wars, but this has from the start, from the Mos Eisley Cantina onwards, felt like a universe where there's a million interesting stories. And I feel like the inclination of The Mandalorian, I know this because James, you discussed this with showrunner Jon Favreau, is to kind of do exactly that. And I just find that to be really interesting. And I'm hoping that this will be a space where we can have some exciting conversations about Star Wars. And we do want to hear from everybody out there. You know, you can tweet at us. James is on Twitter. He's at James Hibbard. I'm on Twitter. I'm at Darren Franich. You can find this podcast wherever you find your podcasts, where you do, give us a rating and give us a review. We'd love to hear from you. There's a million places that cover Star Wars and a million places that talk about Star Wars, and we really want to make this a cool spot to come and discuss all things to do with the franchise. We'll be back next Thursday. Next week, we're going to be discussing The Empire Strikes Back. Still, I think the best Star Wars movie. I don't think that's particularly disputable, but I'd love to hear people dispute it because I love hearing all kinds of opinions, even if I radically disagree with them. Specifically, we're going to talk about a little scene where a man tells a boy that he is his father. Come back next Thursday. Until then, I have spoken.